Welcome to the How to Resist podcast. My name is Will O'Neill. The How to Resist podcast is a space for talking about how anyone can become an activist and take a strategic approach to resisting the Trump administration and making an impact in their communities, their workplace, their country, and the world. Each week, we're going to sit down with an activist who will tell us how they came to be empowered and how they resist the injustices they see around them and the Donald Trump administration. How to Resist isn't a space where we're going to try to convince you why it's important to resist injustice in general, and Trump in particular. There are plenty of other places for that conversation. We're here to let you know that you are empowered to make change in the world around you. This episode premieres on Tuesday, March 6, 2017. Since our episode last Tuesday, Trump held forth before a joint session of Congress, causing pundits to fall all over themselves, since evidently being able to speak for 60 minutes without saying anything overtly offensive is now how they define presidential. But the substance was still racist, Islamophobic, and full of lies. In fact, the Center for American Progress Action Fund counted 51 lies in the speech. It also became clear this week that Attorney General Jeff Sessions lied about meeting Russian officials during the presidential campaign last year, and he was forced to recuse himself from the investigation into Russia's tampering with the election. The GOP is trying to repeal Obamacare again. They hid a bill in different locations in the Capitol last week, but finally they've released it, and it looks like House Republicans are trying to take away health care subsidies, create block grants for Medicaid, cut taxes for the wealthy, and increase taxes for folks who have their health care through their employer, with at least a portion of the amount spent by employers on health care coverage now becoming eligible for taxation as income. That's right, if you've got good health care through your employer, your taxes are going to go up with the GOP's repeal of Obamacare. Trump accused Obama of wiretapping at Trump Tower during the campaign, but there was no evidence of that. Trump also unveiled Muslim Ban 2.0 yesterday. The ban continues to be a clear example of state-sponsored bigotry and Islamophobia, and is being challenged immediately. But that doesn't mean that the Republican government and Customs and Border Protection are going to all of a sudden start respecting basic human rights. State-sponsored hate speech has led to a direct increase in hate crimes against Muslims and Muslim-appearing persons across the country. White nationalism, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia are all on the rise across this nation. The American people want an investigation into Trump's Russia ties, and more heads will roll before that's over. The resistance isn't going anywhere. Immigrants and allies stood in the rain last Tuesday outside the United States Capitol to protest Trump's joint address. Last week, thousands of Bostonians rallied to defend Planned Parenthood. Thousands gathered last night at the White House and at airports to tell immigrants and Muslims that no matter what Trump says, we are a welcoming people. And it isn't just one-off protests anymore. The organizations at the local, state, and national level organizing these events are starting to grow in strength, power, and sophistication. Progressive groups have been energized in a way no one has ever seen. New activists are getting plugged in new ways with organizations that have been fighting the good fight for decades, and groups that are completely new on the scene. That's why I'm so excited to speak with Yvonne Wallace Fuentes. Yvonne is an associate professor of history at Roanoke College and is a founding member of Indivisible Roanoke, one of thousands of indivisible groups that have popped up across the nation since Trump was elected. Yvonne is a mother, educator, and author, and her acts of resistance have been featured on The Rachel Maddow Show and CBS News. She became very energized after Trump was elected president and has been leading creative acts of resistance ever since. Her book, Most Scandalous Woman, Magda Portal and the Dream of Revolution in Peru, will be released in October 2017 by Oklahoma University Press. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on How to Resist. I'm really excited to talk to you today and hear the work that you've been doing. Could you tell me, how are you resisting?
Yeah, so the principal way that I'm resisting right now is by organizing and leading an Indivisible chapter here in Roanoke, Virginia. So I founded Roanoke Indivisible on January 2nd. So it seems like years ago now. So much has happened since then. But that group has grown exponentially. At the beginning of the year, I had a Facebook group with 6 people in it. Now we're probably closer to 1,000.
Oh,
and
wow.
we've done a lot, which to us has just sort of felt like one step after the other, right? We haven't really had a time to sort of plan out a long-term strategy. It's just been, let's do this now, and now let's do this, right? But in general, what we've done is we try to coordinate daily telephone campaigns. So the issue to contact your congressperson about today would be to try to make sure that we have a large number of people who are calling our member of Congress, who for most people here in Roanoke is Bob Goodlatte, who is a very, very powerful Republican member of Congress. He's the chair of the Judiciary Committee and gives us lots to talk to him about. In addition to those telephone campaigns, we have also gone to his district office. We've gone physically. We've organized groups to go to his district office 3 times. We have another one coming up next week. And then probably our largest and most visible action was this past Wednesday on February 22nd. We organized a people's town hall for Bob Goodlatte. So he was actually traveling. He was part of a congressional delegation traveling to India. And so we organized a town hall where his constituents could nonetheless still come and air their concerns and questions about both his legislative positions and the general direction of the country.
And you had responses from him based upon his press releases and his previous statements for those constituents. How are you building off of that?
So what was striking to us when we started thinking about a town hall was that actually Representative Goodlatte had town halls as late as 2013. So he used to have town halls all throughout his district, and then suddenly they stopped. And so now what he has are telephone town halls where random numbers are called up. If you signed up to be part of his phone list, a random subset of those numbers are called up, and you can press a button to try to ask a question, and then he'll try to answer it. But what was striking to us about that was that there was really no chance for dialogue, right? So you
right.
might be able to ask a question, and then he might, you know, say something which actually doesn't always answer the question that is asked, and then there was no chance to ask any follow-up or to really engage in any kind of two-way conversation. And so even though we knew he wasn't there, we didn't want people to feel like they weren't getting those answers, and so we thought it was only fair to try to print out his press releases and his statements, his public record of positions on the questions that we knew were on people's minds, like the ACA and the EPA, of course, immigration, the executive order on travel, commonly known the Muslim ban.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that people had a lot of questions about that, so we just printed out all the stuff that we knew he had already released on his website, so that if people had questions, then you know we could tell them what his positions were. Our moderator at that town hall, Chris Gavaler, is one of the co-organizers of 50 Ways Rockbridge, which is a Lexington, Virginia area indivisible group. And he's been writing this incredible blog since the election called Letters to Bob Goodlatte. And every morning he wakes up and sends an email to Representative Goodlatte based on whatever's in the news in that day. So if there is any one person outside of Goodlatte's office who is well-versed with his positions and his stance on many issues, it was Chris. And so he was the one who then had prepared potential responses based on the representative's public record for the constituents who came to the town hall.
Mm. I think it's very interesting that Goodlatte had stopped doing the town halls a few years ago. Right now we're seeing a lot of people that are stopping doing their town halls as a response to what's coming out of the grassroots indivisible groups in general. How did you hook up with Indivisible?
So this is a long story, so you will stop me if it gets too detailed, but I'm a professor, and I have a young family. I have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. So while I have been politically active and aware most of my life, these past few years, I haven't been as active as I would have liked. So, for example, for the last campaign, I didn't, you know, canvas, I didn't phone bank. I was paying attention to stuff, and I'm driven by data, so I was pretty certain that Hillary Clinton was going to win based on all of the polling information that I could get. And so the night of the election was, for me, a gigantic shock. And that week was really, it threw me for a loop. I would say that I was probably sort of traumatized. I remember, quite frankly, that Saturday night, the cold open for that Saturday Night Live. I don't know if you remember, but it was
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, when Kate did that impression of Hillary Clinton singing Hallelujah at the piano, you know, since Leonard Cohen had just died. I mean, and I burst into tears again, right? Yeah. So, I mean, that was just how frail I still sort of felt and how sort of lost. But the very next day, so this is the Sunday after the election, a Bernie support group here in the Roanoke area called Our Revolution in the Blue Ridge had called a meeting of all area progressives to sort of gather and debrief and ask ourselves, you know, what are the steps going forward? And maybe 100, 150 people showed up to that, which sort of stunned me because I didn't know there were that many people who felt that that mobilized at that moment. And so that group broke up into about six different working groups or task forces. And the task force that I ended up leading out of that, it was one that I suggested, was focused on protecting vulnerable communities in our area. Because I argued, if the administration holds true to its campaign promises, the effects are going to be felt much more strongly by certain communities. So, for example, undocumented people, you know, LGBTQ communities, women, right? I'm a woman. I'm an immigrant. So I really felt very implicated in a lot of these. And so I wanted to do what we could to protect those populations here. And then when I had a chance to actually read the Indivisible Guide over winter break, after I had turned my grades in and had finished copy editing my book, I was able to actually find like a recipe to do what our task force wanted to do. You know, it was very, what I loved about it was that it, in 24 pages, it just explained in very simple steps, if you want to be effective in changing policy, what we know is that adding your name, you know, being the 3 millionth signature on a petition feels good, but it doesn't actually move any politicians.
Yep.
Whereas to move politicians, you should go to the politician who needs your vote, your member of Congress, the person to whom you are a constituent. And so that was just really, it spoke a lot to me because I knew that I didn't have time to devote 24/7 to this. I needed something that was efficient, that was going to be local, that was going to be defensive, that was going to allow me to help my community. And so that's when I registered what at that moment had the incredibly clunky name of, you know, the Roanoke Progressive Action Task Force or whatever,
right,
into Roanoke Indivisible, which is so much better.
Right.
And that's how we officially became affiliated with the Indivisible movement.
I'm very enheartened by the fact that you were talking about centering those historically marginalized voices. And I'm stealing that line from our guest from last week, who said that we need to be centering historically marginalized voices at the heart of all of our work. And could you tell me a little bit more about the Indivisible Guide? It's a 24-page guide, and I know that they have a website and that they've got groups across the country now, and it's been growing by leaps and bounds.
Right. So the Indivisible Guide itself started quite modestly as a Google document. It was created by people who had worked in congressional staffs and district offices, right? So people who had actually been in the front lines interacting with constituents and then seeing how that constituent energy affected their bosses, right? Members of Congress. And so a lot of these progressive congressional staffers had been working in Congress during the Tea Party movement. So this was, if you recall, the first year or so after President Obama had been elected, he actually enjoyed an incredible popularity. He had majorities in Congress. He had won the popular vote quite decisively, right? So you could say that he had a sweeping agenda, a sweeping mandate for his agenda, excuse me.
Yes.
And what ended up happening was that through organization and very efficient targeting of members of Congress, the Tea Party was able to stymie a lot of that agenda, especially when it came to healthcare. And so what these Indivisible Guide authors did is they stopped and they looked and they said, okay, what were they doing so well in terms of constituent advocacy? So how did they come to town halls and encourage members of Congress who might have been much more excited to follow the president's lead and encourage them to pull back, right? Mm-hmm. And so they distilled all of these into the guide, which now I think has been downloaded, you know, I think some millionth time. But what it is a very concrete step-by-step description of how you can efficiently convince and persuade a member of Congress who is your member of Congress to pay attention to you and your concerns.
Yeah. And what are some of those tactics? I know that the Indivisible Guide has a chapter on 4 local advocacy tactics that work.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the tactics that it recommends, and what have you used, and how successful have you been?
Right. So the guiding rule is the more work it takes, the more attention your member of Congress will pay to it, right? So, for example, posting a meme on Facebook doesn't take that much work, right? And so it's not really going to convince people that you are really motivated about a particular issue. However, taking time from a busy workday, right, to go to a district office and actually going to meet either a staffer or a member of Congress, that takes a lot more time and energy. And so the idea is that the member of Congress is convinced, and his or her staff is convinced, that you care more about that agenda based on the effort and the different time and energy that you put into these actions. So what we have done is we do actually coordinate telephone campaigns. So the guide describes those as a, quote, easy lift, unquote. But if you can actually get many, many, many people to call on the same day, offices keep track of these calls, right? And after they trigger a certain number, after they receive a certain number, they inform their member of Congress that, look, we're getting a lot of calls about this issue or about that issue. So every morning I try to post a to-do on our Facebook group, identifying one of the key issues. Usually, hopefully, it's an issue that a member of Congress is soon to take a vote on, something mm-hmm. about which they might still be swayable. And we try to call, and we have we made this little graphic that we use that recommends that people make 6 calls a day, right? That they yeah. call their member of Congress, both the local office and the DC office, and not just your House member, but also your senators, right? So if you can make 6 calls a day, just set out 10 minutes out of your lunch break. We encourage people to pre-program the numbers into their favorites and to set an alarm so that your phone beeps and you know that before you pick up your burger today, this is my time for my calls, right? And if we have all sort of identified these key issues coming forth, then we know that our member of Congress is hearing, right, this concern over and over again. So that's probably on a daily basis what we encourage people to do most often, right? If you can do nothing else, do your call. And then we try to organize these district office visits. And again, we've done them 3 times. We have another one coming up, and those take a little bit more coordination. Usually they take about a week to plan. We try to get a substantial group, at least 12, to be able to go down there because we think that there is power in numbers. And that power works both ways, right? It works for the people who are going because sometimes, people are very anxious. They don't know what they're supposed to do. Yeah, and then they're afraid that they have to convince somebody. And the first thing we say is, it is not your job to convince any staffer or member of Congress. It is their job to listen. All you have to do is show up and tell them how you feel about something. You don't have to persuade them. And so the first few times that people either pick up the phone, actually, but certainly when they're actually going to the district office, can be a very fraught time full of social anxiety. So having a group there, I think, is very helpful because you know you're going with, as the kids say these days, your squad, right? Mm-hmm. And it feels a little more comfortable. And it's also, I think, powerful to the staffer and to the member of Congress to see that, this is a group of people who care enough about this to have half a dozen, a dozen, 2 dozen people who are going to take time out of their day to come talk to us. And I'm sure that they have the same calculus that we have in our head, that every one body that makes it to the office actually represents dozens of others who wish they could, right? But for some reason couldn't that day. And it indicates the level of commitment and energy that is behind some of these issues at any particular time.
Yeah, I know my cousin's been doing actually a thing called Tuesdays with Toomey in Pennsylvania, right, where every Tuesday they go to Toomey's office and they present a concern and they get together on their lunch break, and it's just a regular thing. And doing those things like that, where it's something that that there's going to be, you're going to be rolling deep, as the kids might say, mm-hmm. And you've got a group of people behind you and taking that time to do that. One of the things that I've always heard was, it's better to send a postcard, but then if you can send a handwritten letter, someone's going to read the handwritten letter. And you're absolutely right that the more effort it takes to sort of produce the piece of action, the more seriously it's going to be taken. Have you come to think of yourself as an activist through doing this?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to parse the feelings that have rolled over me in the past, 5 weeks, right? I mean, things are happening so quickly. At the very beginning of this, I don't think I would have recognized myself as an activist or a leader in any kind of way. But now it's clear that, that there are these things, you know, we've built these things. We had our first face-to-face meeting for members of the Facebook group, oh, maybe like 2.5 weeks ago, and 130 people showed up, right, in this part of Virginia, which is sort of like, we were amazed. We were like, oh my God, right?
That's so fantastic.
It's incredible. And so now we feel a responsibility. I feel a responsibility to these people, right? Because these people have joined us thinking, here is a group of people who are taking actions, right? Here's a group of people who can help create a community, not just of activists, but of sympathizers in a part of the country where not everybody you meet is sympathetic to your political beliefs, right? Uh-huh. And so we take those things quite seriously, and that sort of drives us forward. So yeah, I guess now I would think of myself certainly as an activist. I don't think it's the primary layer to my identity right now. I am still primarily a mother. I am still a professor. I still have all of these other things that I have to juggle first. And most of the activism that I am doing, I actually squeeze in an hour or two before bed. You know, that's what I can do with my laptop. And I can sort of program some of the posts that I want to show up on our Facebook page the next day. And so you find ways of trying to make what you need to do to keep your energy going, as well as guiding the group that is growing behind you. You find ways to fit that into an already busy life. And that, I think, to me, had been one of the first fears. I had been afraid that, you know, if I dive into this, it's going to take over and my children will starve or will only eat Cheetos. And, you know, and now I realize, no, my children are fine, right? And you find ways. And yeah, maybe I haven't, you know, kept up with my Netflix binging quite as much. But, you know, if that's what it takes, like, I'm cool with that, right?
Yeah, and that's a sacrifice you can make.
Right, right. Netflix will always be there. And so I think one of the things for me that has been really important in coming to terms with this new facet of my identity as an activist is recognizing that it is one facet among many, right? And that it is something that I can fit into my life in bursts of, you know, an hour here, 2 hours there, and that it's going to actually really nourish my roots in this community. I've met so many people in the last 5 weeks. Like, I feel so much more involved in my community. And I've been here for 10 years. And just in these last 5 weeks, I have now felt like I'm a part of this community much more authentically than in any time in those past 10 years. So for me, it has actually been very nourishing.
And some of the folks that are coming to that meeting for that first time, do they have some of the same concerns about it being something that's going to take over their life? What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them that, you know, many hands make small work, right? And if it were just three of us and we had to do all of this together, then yes, those three people are going to end up having a lot of things to do. But if there's 130 of us, right, and everybody can do half an hour here or an hour there, then suddenly, as long as you can organize the logistics, and that's not an immediate given, right? But, you know, you can do it. Then suddenly you are capable as a group of doing a lot more. So, for example, with our People's Town Hall that we just did, one of our organizers came up with this incredible online scheduler. And people could just, you know, click this link and it said, can you come in half an hour before to, you know, put chairs up? Mm-hmm. And even if you couldn't stay for 3 hours because it's a work day, right?
Yeah.
You might be able to come in for half hour here or half hour at the end. Or if you couldn't do that, maybe you could donate $20 towards the rental fee for the venue. Or if you couldn't do that, maybe you're a printer and you can actually help with printing the pamphlets and all that kind of stuff. And if you can organize that into an online form or some other way that people can access it in their off time as you're planning for it, we were able to get lots of people to help. And that made it easy. It made it viable. And I think it was actually really important because people want to help, right? People really want to find like the hour or the half hour or what can I do? And if you can find places where people can anchor in those smaller chunks, then they become really involved in the life of the group. It's their group too, because they've now contributed to it. And so we're really cognizant of trying to create those spaces where everybody has something that they feel that they can do and trying to make sure that people feel like this is our collective task together.
Yeah. And how can someone plug into the work that you're doing, either in your area or nationwide? Because I know that there are indivisible groups everywhere.
Yeah, so there are thousands of indivisibly aligned groups now, which is really on its face also just astonishing and amazing and so exciting. So if somebody really wanted to join the Indivisible group, the first thing that you would do is you would go online and at the Indivisible Guides website, they have an engine where you can plug in your zip code and they'll tell you all of the groups in your area that have registered with the Indivisible movement. And they'll have contact information there so that you can find a group to join. Some of these groups had longstanding connections to their communities. For example, when I first registered my group on in January, there had already been one group that had registered, and it was involved in environmental protections in the Jefferson Davis National Forest here in Virginia, right? It's a little bit further away from where I was, and I felt like it was necessary to have something a little more local to Roanoke, so I felt comfortable registering my own group. But so even if there is another issue that really sort of drives you further, if you were to look on the Indivisible Guide, you might very well find that some of those groups have already registered. And then once you plug into one of those groups, of course, many of these groups are starting. There's a lot of energy. Most of them have Facebook groups. Most of them are now starting up their mailing lists and are trying to create lots of opportunities for people to participate both online in fora like Facebook pages and Google groups, but then also so that you can start creating moments where activism becomes a habit for you too, like Tuesdays with Toomey, right? Or Moral Mondays, another great example out of North Carolina, right? Anything you can do to sort of start scheduling it in so that you know that, you know, every third Sunday I'm going to do this, or every first Monday I'm going to do that, then I think that helps you start recognizing this kind of activism as a regular part of who you are now.
How are you taking the activism that you're doing now? How is that? What are you getting out of it personally?
Well, as I said earlier, I feel much more connected to my community. That to me was actually surprising and has been so, it's nourishing. Like I now feel connected to my community and to new neighbors in ways that I didn't before. But remember how I also talked at the beginning how the week after the election, I was just sort of like lost and sort of buffeted by the wind. I don't feel that way anymore. Like I don't feel despondent. I try to be clear-eyed. I know that the next 2 years, 4 years, God forbid 8 years are going to be really rough. Like some things will be lost. There's just no way of imagining how that's not going to happen with the congressional majorities and the clear signal we're getting from congressional majorities that they're willing to dump all sorts of things to enact the most extreme version of their agenda. But I now feel like even if we take those body blows, we can resist. Like we can fight back. We will rebuild. So one of the things that has been so important for me personally out of this is that it has allowed me to regain my sense of agency. So even though I know I won't be able to stop the congressional steamrolling of this country, I can do my little bit. And that little bit, combined with a little bit of my friends and neighbors here in Roanoke, might help make our community better for our neighbors and defend some key progressive issues and communities. And I think we're already seeing that, right? I mean, I think it was just yesterday we had a Republican go on air and claim that the ACA was not going to be repealed because they're getting so much pressure, right? Yeah. So much pushback at these town halls.
Yeah. And John Boehner was talking about how they're just going to do stuff around the edges. And I think that's
right.
You know, the absolute reality of that issue is that there isn't a conservative version of healthcare that isn't going to kill a lot of people. And they don't have a replacement plan after 7-8 years of talking about it.
Or if you take a look at what the ACA is, it is the conservative healthcare plan, right? I mean, yes. That was the one that was created if you take a look at like everything from Bob Dole through Romney, right? And so you can't actually do anything less than that unless you just leave it up to the free market where people die, right? As you mentioned, right? So I think what this kind of activism for me has done is that it has allowed me to regain my sense of agency, regain my sense of who I am as both a citizen and a constituent, as a person with power. It has really sort of made it clear to me that this democratic system that we have, for me, wasn't really real before because in many ways, I wasn't taking daily action, right? I wasn't calling my member of Congress every day or every other day. And now I am. And that reminds me that this is my republic too, and that I have a say, and that it is my member of Congress's job to listen to me. And my opinions may not be reflected in his vote, but he still has to listen to me. He doesn't get to ignore me just because my politics don't match his. Uh-huh. And that was exactly what the Tea Party was able to prove, right? 8 years ago, and now we're doing it too. This is how politics should work. You have to listen to what I say, even if that isn't reflected then in the legislative action that you take. And eventually, enough of us will raise our voices that we become an incentive that they have to pay attention to. And that changes the agenda. That changes politics.
Yeah. And you've referenced the Tea Party groups a number of times. How would you say that what's going on with Indivisible or other organizations that are out there right now, how do you think it's the same and how do you think it's different? Because I know that we latch on to the things that we understand and we right. somewhat have an understanding of what the Tea Party was. But some of those tactics we can't repeat necessarily.
Right. And wouldn't want to.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, if you take a look at some of those early Tea Party rallies, like some racial language was used that I would never want to see again. And the energy was in many cases quite negative. So what I see as similar is that both of these are effective constituent advocacy groups, right? There are moments when constituents felt empowered and emboldened to participate in the legislative process. So what the Tea Party does as an example then is it proves what can be possible, right? And it's actually an even better example of what can be possible because right now the current administration is nowhere near as popular as Obama was after his election, right? They do enjoy congressional majorities in Congress, the Republicans today, much like the Democrats did 8 years ago. But the popular vote suggests that there isn't a popular mandate for this very extreme version of the Republican agenda, which is unlike what the Democrats enjoyed 8 years ago. So the fact that the Tea Party was able to mobilize so effectively and affect policy so effectively, even given those headwinds, should be for us a great source of energy because we have more people who are very wary of this Republican agenda. And I actually see that here. There are many people who are independents or who identify as Republicans who, once they actually learn the extreme nature of what's happening in Congress, are appalled, right? Like they might think of themselves as Republicans, but that doesn't mean that they want to see the EPA completely disappear, right? Because there's a bill in one line that says we're going to get rid of it entirely. So it's a much more extreme version of what I think everyday Republicans would like to see. And once that becomes clear to them, then they feel emboldened to protect parts of the agenda that they also feel are under threat. So in that sense, I think they're similar. They are both moments where constituents felt emboldened to participate in their political process. But what's different is that I think the energy today for the Indivisibly Aligned groups is much more positive, right? It is defensive in that we're trying to protect our friends and neighbors, but it's not defensive where we feel like we can't defend and celebrate the values that are bringing us together. Because the values that are bringing us together and that are taking us to pick up the phone or to go to a district office is let's take care of our neighbors, right? It's not right that, for example, here we're keeping people who had been already cleared to enter the country, right? Keeping them stuck in an airport just because this travel, this executive order on travel was written in such a way that, you know, people had no idea what was going to happen to them when they actually landed at an airport. So the values that are driving us to participate are values that we can all celebrate and that are progressive values and are about inclusion and about protecting the vulnerable and about creating a country and a climate where everybody feels that they have an equal say. And that, to me, I think is a little different from the energy that was driving the Tea Party, which was more about this backward sort of nostalgic view of some past where everything was better. I'm looking forward, right? I'm looking to a country where people feel both included and emboldened and empowered to participate as citizens, independent of where they might have been born or what the color of their skin is or what their religion is. And that I do think is a little different.
Yeah, I think it's incredible, not incredible, but I think it's really interesting that you talk about looking forward because you're a history professor and you spend a lot of your time looking back in the past. Now you're a professor of Latin American history. How does that inform what you're doing right now?
So I have like two answers to that. One is sort of like the history professor answer, which I'll start with. But then there's also sort of like the person who actually studies Latin American history and who sort of observes and lives it as a citizen and a human being. But as a history professor, I'm informed by recognizing that there is no such thing as a straight line of progress, right? Like we like to believe that we're at the apex of human history and that everything had to happen this way because Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So, of course, it had to have happened that way, right? And this is a key way that human beings think about their past. But if you study history, you realize, no, actually, history can go in any sort of way, right? Like, there are moments mm-hmm. that contingencies happen, and history can veer off in that way, and everybody's sort of unexpected spectators to something that they never thought was plausible. And so, in that sense, I look at what has happened here not as a an inevitable repudiation, for example, of what the Democratic Party stood for or what Hillary Clinton stood for. Like, it, you know, sometimes stuff happens, right? And it's not like it was meant to happen or fated to happen or, you know, God was going to intervene to make sure it happened that way. That's just the way it is. And in Latin America in particular, the 20th century was full of mobilizations under situations that were much more difficult than the ones we're living in right now. Mm-hmm. And those people found a way, those populations, those nations found a way to find the courage to go to the streets and to overturn military dictatorships that were incredibly bloody and much more fearsome than what we have now. And so in that sense, it emboldens me to know that we are now just part of like this larger human story in the 20th century, when sometimes our governments do things that we don't really like, and we feel like we need to go and make sure that our governments know, no, this is not the way that I would like us to see our country go. Personally, I was born in Guatemala. And so my earliest my earliest memories were rooted in Guatemala in the late 70s and early 80s, which for your listeners who are familiar with the history of Guatemala was a really bloody time. So there was a civil conflict there, which eventually in the highlands, I was in Guatemala City, so I didn't see this, you know, the most terrible forms of the violence. But in the highlands would eventually be judged by the United Nations to have consisted of, you know, to have merit the term of genocide for the amount of violence that the military state perpetrated on indigenous communities. But still, some of my very earliest memories were of, you know, people walking around with big guns and violence, most of it political, represented in newspapers and TV. And my mother, who is from Guatemala, her entire youth was spent in this political environment. And so when we first started our work here in Roanoke, one of the very first things that we did was we visited Bob Goodlatte's office in on like January 3rd, January 4th, to take him good New Year's cards. And so that particular action, we took a little video selfie of it, and it was picked up by Rachel Maddow, and we got a lot of attention about that. But it happened so quickly, I didn't have a chance to tell my family about it. And so my mother caught it on a rerun, but having no idea that I was going to be on TV. Like, and so she's just hanging out at her house, and she suddenly sees my face pop up, right? It leads Maddow that night. And she told me later that her first heartbeat was one of deep dread, because she came from a political society where if you see a loved one's face on TV talking about politics, like, there is no way that's good news. Like, that can only lead to a bad outcome. And then she said, but her very next breath, like her next heartbeat was like, oh, no, in this country, you can do it, right? And so I take that and I say, in this country, not only can we do it, we have to do it. It's worth doing it, right? So in many ways, the work that I do as a Latin American historian, and, you know, I write about revolution. I'm interested in women in politics. Like, my book is about a Peruvian woman who leads a revolution in the 20th century. All of that helps me realize that what we're doing now in this country is both possible. People have done much more under many, many more difficult circumstances, and it's worth it, because what we have in this country is something that most other political cultures could only dream of having, which is both the space and the infrastructure and the moral certainty that what we're doing is right. We need to get out into those streets. We have not just the ability, but the responsibility to shape our political future. That's what it means to be a citizen in the United States of America.
Yeah. And what's your book called? And when's it coming out?
So it's coming out in October, I believe. It's called Most Scandalous Woman, Magda Portal and the Dream of Revolution in Peru.
Oh, very, very cool.
I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, no, that sounds really, really exciting. How are you balancing all these things? How are you preventing yourself from being burned out? You're writing a book, you're teaching classes, you've got two little ones, you're doing all this activism. How are you keeping centered?
Well, for example, you could never come to my house because it's a filthy mess, right? So you just let some things go, right? It happened that the book now is in production, so that stuff is done. My classes, for the most part, are classes I've taught before, so some of that work has already been done. But the real answer is I'm taking it from what before might have been recreational time, especially late at night, early in the morning, lunchtime, right? You grab 10 or 15 minutes here, and you try to cobble all of that together. And thankfully, with the digital tools that we have now, like, for example, Facebook groups, I can do a lot in 10 minutes, right, during lunchtime. I can make my 6 calls. Like, that's done, right? And at night, I can do a lot of the research that sort of drives what we think might be potential to-do items in the future, or a lot of the organizing, for example, for things like district office visits or town halls can happen. So the actual face-to-face time that we've met with other people in the group, I would probably say at the most has been at a dozen hours since January. Most of the work is being done in conference calls, online, and a lot of that can be stuffed into or condensed into 10 or 15 minutes here or there. But yeah, it can be at times a little exhilarating to think, you know, I have 5 balls in the air, like which one is going to fall first? as long as my children are fed, like I've decided that I'm willing to take that risk. I have personally committed, and this was long before the Indivisible chapter here took off the way it has. I personally committed myself to the Robert Reich thesis that for the 100 days we have to go as hard as we can, as hard as we can. And so I committed to myself as a person and a citizen and a mother for 100 days. I'm going to do everything I possibly can. I had no idea it was going to be this much, right? That I'd be like talking to you on a podcast. Like I had no idea that it would take off that way, but I am still going to hold true to that for 100 days. Anything I can do, I'm going to try to do 110%. And then after that, you know, life will take over. Like we have to be able to pace ourselves, to take time for ourselves, to ensure that we still have time to spend with our family, because that's why we're doing all of this, right? But I do think that it was important, not just for the movement, but for the politics of the country, to demonstrate from the very beginning that this was not, that there was an act of resistance. And I think we've done that as a movement. And so I will feel much more comfortable when my 100 days are up, taking a day or two off, right? And maybe disappearing for a weekend and sort of recharging, because I know that I did what I could and that at that moment, other people are stepping up.
Well, now it's time for the How to Resist quick question round. I'm just going to ask you really quickly some questions, and if you could respond as quickly as possible. What's the best sign that you've seen at a rally?
There was one at the Women's March that was the top tweet lies that Donald Trump had given up to that point, and it was like all text. And the man who was holding it said, and I still couldn't fit 12 of them, right? That was a spectacular sign.
Who's the worst member of the cabinet?
Sessions.
Who's your least favorite member of Congress?
Bob Goodlatte.
Who's your favorite member of Congress?
Warren.
Warren. How do you get pumped up for your activism? What song do you listen to?
So I have an entire playlist, and right now there's a lot of Bruno Mars on it.
And what's your favorite chant?
My favorite chant, El Pueblo Unido Jamás Será Vencido, which is a classic one from Latin America that means the people united will never be defeated.
And is it okay to punch a Nazi in the face?
I am a woman of peace, but if somebody punched a Nazi in the face beside me, I probably wouldn't stop them.
What was the last book that you read?
The last book that I read was, it's called Envisioning Eden. It's about tourist imaginaries and heritage tourism.
What's a question that you'd like to hear asked on this podcast?
If you could help somebody who had no idea how to get started, what would you do?
All right. And what's the worst thing that Trump's done yet?
I would say probably the travel ban.
I don't know. Okay. Well, that's all the time that we have for the quick question round. But could you answer that question that you asked? And you know, what would you tell someone who has maybe gone to one rally, maybe someone that went to the Women's March? What would you tell them?
I would tell them two things. One, one of the things that kept me from getting involved was that I was afraid I was going to screw it up, right? I was afraid that, you know, if I get involved, maybe I don't know enough about local politics, or maybe I don't know enough about where my member of Congress stands or something, or maybe the strategy I come up with is a bad one. So, for example, we just did this Facebook campaign where we tried to get people to read the Constitution in segments, and we tried to make it like a Facebook challenge, right? Sort of like the Ice Bucket Challenge, which I still think is a great idea, but was so complicated, nobody could follow it, right? So on the one hand, it's like, was that a failure? We didn't actually get the kind of traction that the Ice Bucket Challenge got. And yet, I've had conservative friends and family tell me that that was the first thing they could like on my page in like 2 months, right? Because if there is one thing that could unite us all, it is that, yes, people should read the Constitution. So even though it didn't meet my previously conceived notion of what would be a success, it was a success. And what that has taught me is throw yourself into the abyss. Of course, you're going to make mistakes, but from those mistakes, new ideas will emerge, right? And so I don't think that you can our situation right now is difficult enough nationally that nothing you will do could possibly screw it up further, right? You can only make the situation better. And then the other thing I would say is that it's been a lot of fun, right? I think some people have an idea of political activism as being sort of like grinding and, you know, it's going to be like a bunch of policy, and I'm going to have to learn these big words, and yeah, I'm going to be up till 3 o'clock, you know, trying to parse this about that, or, you know, I'm going to get arrested. And it, none of that has happened to me. What has happened was that I've learned more about my community. I feel emboldened to let my member of Congress know what I think. I have made new friends, and I now feel like I'm an active citizen in a way that I have never felt in my life. So it has both been fun, and I have overcome that fear that I'm going to screw up, because I know that as long as we're participating, as long as we're just being citizens in our democracy and active constituents, you can't mess up. The whole system was created so that you would do this.
Uh-huh. Well, Yvonne, thank you so much for being on. I'm really excited to have this podcast go out and have people listen to your experience. And I just really want to thank you for taking the time for that.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to How to Resist. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher and leave a review. Notes from the show, including links, can be found on howtoresistpodcast.com. While you're there, sign up for our email updates. Thanks to Beth Soderbergh for help with our website, Sariel Layani for logo and design, and Carolyn Hanrahan for production assistance. Thank you for listening. I'm Will O'Neill. Thank you for resisting.